this Brilliance Audio production of
Beyond the Highland Mist by Karen Marie Mawning. Beltane, spring. You spotted snakes with double tongue, thorny hedgehogs be not seen, newts and blind worms do no wrong, come not near our fairy queen. Shakespeare, A Midsummer Night's Dream. Prologue. Scotland. 1st February, 1513. The fragrance of jasmine and sandalwood drifted through the rowan trees. Above dew-drenched branches, a lone gull ghosted a bank of mist and soared to kiss the dawn over the white sands of Morar. The turquoise tide shimmered in shades of mermaid tails against the alabaster shore. The elegant royal court of the Tuatha De Danann dappled the stretch of lush greenery. Pillowed chaises in brilliant scarlet and lemon adorned the grassy knoll, scattered in a half-moon about the outdoor dais.
"They say he's even more beautiful than you,"
the queen remarked to the man sprawled indolently at the foot of her dais. "Impossible!" His mocking laughter tinkled like cut crystal chimes on a fey wind.
"They say his manhood at half-mast would make a stallion envious."
The queen slanted a glance beneath half-lowered lids at her rapt courtiers.
"More likely a mouse," sneered the man at her feet.
Elegant fingers demonstrated a puny space of air, and titters sliced the mist.
"They say, at full mast, he steals a woman's mind from her body, claims her soul."
The queen dropped fringed lashes to shield eyes alight with the iridescent fire of mischievous intent.
"How easily my men are provoked," she thought.
The man rolled his eyes, and disdain etched his arrogant profile. He crossed his legs at the ankles and gazed out across the sea. But the queen wasn't fooled. The man at her feet was vainglorious, and not as impervious to her provocation as he feigned.
"Quit baiting him, my queen," King Finvera admonished. "You know how the fool gets when his ego is wounded."
He patted her arm soothingly.
"You've teased him enough."
The queen's eyes narrowed thoughtfully. She briefly considered foregoing this vein of revenge. A calculating look at her men dashed that thought, as she recalled what she'd overheard them discussing late last evening in excruciating detail. The things they'd said were unforgivable. The queen was not a woman to be compared with another woman, and found lacking. Her lip tightened imperceptibly. Her exquisitely delicate hand curled into a fist. She carefully selected her next words.
"But I have found him to be all that they say,"
the queen purred. In the silence that followed, the statement lingered, unacknowledged, for the cut was too cruel to dignify. The king at her side and the man at her feet shifted restlessly. She was beginning to think she hadn't made her point quite painfully clear enough, when, in unison, they rose to her bait.
"Who is this man?"
Queen Avile of the Fairy disguised a satisfied smile with a delicate yawn and drank deeply of her men's jealousy.
"They call him the Hawk."
Chapter 1. Scotland. 1st April, 1513. Shehawk James Lyon Douglas, 3rd Earl of Dalkeith, stalked across the floor. Droplets of water trickled from his wet hair down his broad chest and gathered into a single rivulet between the double ridges of muscle in his abdomen. Moonlight shimmered through the open window, casting a silvery glow to his bronze skin, creating the illusion that he was sculpted of molten steel. The tub behind him had grown cold and been forgotten. The woman on the bed was also cold and forgotten. She knew it, and she didn't like it one bit.
"Too beautiful for me," Esmeralda thought.
But by the saints, the man was a poison draught, another long, cool swallow of his body, the only cure for the toxin. She thought about the things she had done to win him, to share his bed, and, God forgive her, the things she would do to stay there. She almost hated him for it. She knew she hated herself for it.
"He should be mine," she thought.
She watched him stalk across the spacious room to the window which opened between fluted granite columns that met in a high arch 20 feet above her head. Esmeralda sneered at him behind his back. Foolish. Such large, unprotected openings in a keep. Or arrogant. So what if one could lie in the massive goose-down bed and gaze through the rosy arch at a velvety sky pierced by glittering stars? She'd caught him gazing that way tonight, as he'd slammed into her, exciting that bottomless hunger in her blood with the rock-hard kind of maleness only he possessed. She'd whimpered beneath him in the greatest ecstasy she'd ever experienced, and he'd been looking out the window, as if no one else was there with him. Had he been counting the stars? Silently reciting bawdy ditties to prevent himself from toppling over and falling asleep? She'd lost him. No, Esmeralda vowed. She would never lose him.
Hawk!
She smoothed the lavender silk sheet through her trembling fingers.
Come back to bed, Hawk.
I'm restless tonight, sweet. He toyed with the stem of a large pale blue blossom. A half hour earlier he'd swept the dewy petals along her silken skin. Esmeralda flinched at his open admission that he still had energy to spare. Sleepily sated, she could see that his body still thrummed from head to toe with restless vigor. What kind of woman would it take, or how many, to leave that man drowsing in fascinated satisfaction? More woman than she, and ye gods, how that offended her! Had her sister left him more sated? Her sister who had warmed his bed until Zeldy had found a way to take her place?
Am I better than my sister?
The words were out before she could prevent them. She bit her lip, anxiously awaiting his answer. Her words dragged his smoky gaze from the starry night across the wide expanse of the bedchamber to rest on the sultry, raven-haired gypsy. Esmeralda, he chided gently.
Am I?
Her husky contralto soared to a shrewish pitch. He sighed. We've had this discussion before.
And you never answer me.
Stop comparing yourself, sweet. You know it's foolish.
How can I not, when you can compare me to 100, nay, 1,000, even my own sister?
Shapely brows puckered in a scowl above her flashing eyes. His laughter rolled. And how many do you compare me to, lovely Esmeralda?
My sister couldn't have been as good as me. She was nearly a virgin.
She spit out the word with distaste. Life was too unpredictable for virginity to be a prized possession among her people. Lust, in all its facets, was a healthy aspect of the Rom culture. He raised a hand in warning. Stop. Now. But she couldn't. The poison words of accusation tumbled out fast and furious at the only man who had ever made her pagan blood sing, and his boredom between her thighs had been chiseled in granite upon his perfect face this very eve. In truth, for many evenings now. He suffered her rage in silence, and when at last her tongue rested, he turned back to his window. The howl of a solitary wolf ruptured the night, and she felt an answering cry well up within her. She knew the hawk's silence was his farewell. Stinging with rejection and humiliation, she lay trembling in his bed, the bed she knew she would never be asked to enter again. She would kill for him, which is precisely what she meant to do moments later, when she rushed him with the silver dirk she'd slipped from the table by the bed. Esmeralda might have been able to leave without swearing an oath of vengeance, if he had looked surprised, momentarily alarmed, sorry, even. But he exhibited none of these emotions. His perfect face lit up with laughter as he spun effortlessly, caught her arm, and sent the dirk hurtling through the open window. He laughed, and she cursed him, and all his begotten and any subsequent misbegotten. When he shushed her with kisses, she cursed through gritted teeth, even as her traitorous body melted for his touch. No man should be so beautiful. No man should be so untouchable, and so damned fearless. No man should be able to forsake Esmeralda. He was done with her. But she wasn't done with him. She would never be done with him.
It wasn't your fault, Hawk, Grim offered.
They sat upon the cobbled terrace of Dalkeith, sipping port and smoking imported tobacco in purely male contentment.
Shahawk James Lyon Douglas rubbed his perfect jaw with a perfect hand, irritated by the perfect shadow of stubble that always appeared just a few hours after shaving.
"I just don't understand, Grim. I thought she'd found pleasure with me. Why would she seek to kill me?"
Grim arched a brow.
"Just what do you do to the lasses in bed, Hawk?"
"I give them what they want. Fantasy. My willing flesh and blood to serve their every whim."
"And how do you know what a woman's fantasies are?"
Grim wondered aloud. The Earl of Dalkeith laughed softly, a heady, confident rumble of a purr that he knew drove women wild.
"Ah, Grim, you just have to listen with your whole body. In her eyes she tells you, whether she knows it or not. In her soft cries she guides you. In the subtle turnings of her body, you know if she wants you in front or behind her lush curves, with gentleness or with power. If she desires a tender lover or seeks a beast, if she likes her lips kissed or savagely devoured, if she likes her breasts..."
"I get the picture,"
Grim interrupted, swallowing hard. He shifted in his chair and uncrossed his legs, recrossed them, and tugged at his kilt, uncrossed them again and sighed.
"And Esmeralda? Did you understand her fantasies?"
"Only too well. One of them included being Lady Hawk."
"Well, she had to know it couldn't be Hawk. Everyone knows you've been as good as wed since King James decreed your betrothal."
"As good as dead. And I don't want to talk about it."
"The time draws near, Hawk. You're not only going to have to talk about it, you're going to have to do something about it. Like go collect your bride. Time is running out, or don't you care?"
Hawk slanted a savage look Grim's way.
"Just making sure, that's all. There's scarce a fortnight left, remember?"
Hawk stared out into the crystalline night, heavy with glowing stars.
"How could I forget? You really think James would carry out his threats if you don't wed the Coleman lass?"
"Absolutely," Hawk said flatly.
"I just don't understand why he hates you so much."
A sardonic smile flitted across the Hawk's face. He knew why James hated him. 30 years ago, Hawk's parents had humiliated James to the seat of his vain soul. Since the Hawk's father had died before James could avenge himself, the king had turned on Hawk in his father's stead. For 15 long years, James had controlled every minute of the Hawk's life. Days before his pledge of service was to expire, James contrived a plan to affect every future moment of it. By the king's decree, the Hawk was being forced to wed a lass he didn't know and didn't want, a reclusive spinster who was rumored to be quite hideous and unquestionably mad. It was King James's twisted idea of a lifetime sentence.
"Who fathoms the minds of kings, my friend?"
Hawk evaded, pointedly putting an end to the topic. The two men passed a time in silence, both brooding for different reasons as they stared into the velvety sky. An owl hooted softly from the gardens. Crickets rubbed their legs in sweet concerto, offering twilight tribute to Dalkeith. Stars pulsed and shimmered against the night's blue-black canopy.
"Look! One falls! There, Hawk! What do you make of it?"
Grim pointed at a white speck plummeting from the heavens, leaving a milky tail glowing in its wake.
"Esmeralda says, if you make a wish upon such a falling star, 'twill be granted."
"Did you wish just now?"
"Tinker talk," Hawk scoffed. "Foolish romantic nonsense for dreamy-eyed lasses."
Of course he'd wished. Every time he'd seen a falling star lately, always the same wish. After all, the time was nearing.
"Well, I'm trying it,"
Grim grumbled, not to be swayed by Hawk's mockery.
"I wish..."
"Yield, Grim. What's your wish?" Hawk asked curiously.
"None of your concern. You don't believe."
"I? The eternal romantic who enchants legions with his poetry and seduction? Not a believer in all those lovely female things?" Grim shot his friend a warning look.
"Careful, Hawk. Mock them at your own risk. You may just really make a lass angry one day, and you won't know how to deal with it. For the time being, they still fall for your perfect smiles."
"You mean like this one?" Hawk arched a brow and flashed a smile, complete with sleepily hooded eyes that spoke volumes about how the lass receiving it was the only true beauty in his heart, a heart which had room for only one, whoever happened to be in the hawk's arms at the moment. Grim shook his head in mock disgust.
You practice it. You must. Come on, admit it.
Of course I do. It works. Wouldn't you practice it?
Womanizer.
Mm-hmm, Hawk agreed.
Do you even remember the names?
All 5,000 of them. Hawk hid his grin behind a swallow of port.
Blackguard. Libertine.
Rogue. Roué. Cad. Ah, here's a good one. Voluptuary, Hawk supplied helpfully.
Why don't they see through you?
Hawk shrugged a shoulder. They like what they get from me. There are a lot of hungry lasses out there. I couldn't in good conscience turn them away. 'Twould trouble my head.
I think I know exactly which head of yours would be troubled,
Grim said dryly.
The very one that's going to get you in big trouble one day.
What did you wish for, Grim? Hawk ignored the warning with the devil-may-care attitude that was his wont where the lasses were concerned. A slow smile slid over Grimm's face.
A lass who doesn't want you. A lovely, nay, an earth-shatteringly beautiful one, with wit and wisdom to boot. One with a perfect face and a perfect body and a perfect no on her perfect lips for you, my oh-so-perfect friend. And I also wish to be allowed to watch the battle.
Hawk smiled smugly. It will never happen. The wind gusting sweetly through the pines carried a disembodied voice that drifted on a breeze of jasmine and sandalwood. Then it spoke, in laughing words neither man heard.
I think that can be arranged.
Chapter 2. The mystical isle of Morar was cloaked in eventide, the silica sands glistening silver beneath King Finvera's boots as he paced, impatiently awaiting the court fool's return. The queen and her favorite courtiers were merrily celebrating the Beltane in a remote highland village. Watching his elfin Avil dance and flirt with the mortal Highlanders had goaded his slumbering jealousy into wakeful wrath. He'd fled the Beltane fires before he could succumb to his desire to annihilate the entire village. He was too angry with mortals to trust himself around them at the moment. The mere thought of his queen with a mortal man filled him with fury. As the fairy queen had her favorites among their courtiers, so did the fairy king. The wily court fool was his long-time companion in cups and spades. He'd dispatched the fool to study the mortal hawk, to gather information so he might concoct a fitting revenge for the man who dared trespass on fairy territory.
His manhood at half-mast would make a stallion envious. He claims a woman's soul.
King Finvera mocked his queen's words in scathing falsetto, then spit irritably.
I'm afraid it's true, the fool said flatly as he appeared in the shade of a rowan tree.
Really?
King Finvera grimaced. He'd convinced himself Avil had embellished a bit. After all, the man was mortal. The fool scowled.
I spent 3 days in Edinburgh. The man's a living legend. The women clamor over him. They speak his name as if it's some mystic incantation guaranteed to bestow eternal ecstasy.
Did you see him? With your own eyes? Is he beautiful?
The king asked quickly. The fool nodded and his mouth twisted bitterly.
He's flawless. He's taller than me.
You're well over 6 feet in that glamour,
the king objected.
He stands almost a hand taller. He has raven hair worn in a sleek tail, smoldering black eyes, the chiseled perfection of a young god and the body of a Viking warrior. It's revolting. May I maim him, my liege? Disfigure his perfect countenance?
King Finvera pondered this information. He felt sick in the pit of his stomach at the thought of this dark mortal touching his queen's fair limbs, bringing her incomparable pleasure, claiming her soul.
I will kill him for you,
the fool offered hopefully. King Finvera gestured impatiently.
Fool! And break the compact between our races?
No, there must be another way. The fool shrugged.
Perhaps we should sit back and do nothing. The hawk is about to come to harm at his own race's hand.
Tell me more, Finvera ordered, his interest piqued.
I discovered that the hawk is to be wed in a few days. He is affianced by his mortal king's decree. Destruction is about to befall him. You see, my liege, King James has ordered the hawk to wed a woman named Janet Coman. The king has made it clear that if the hawk doesn't wed this woman, he will destroy both the Douglas and Coman clans.
So, what's your point? Finvera asked impatiently.
Janet Coman is dead. She died today.
Finvera tensed instantly.
Did you harm her, fool?
No, my liege. The fool gave him a wounded look. She died by her father's hand. I no more put the idea in his head than a key to a tower in his sporran.
Does that mean you did, or you didn't put the idea in his head? The king asked suspiciously.
Come now, my liege, the fool pouted. Think you I would resort to such trickery and jeopardize us all?
Finvera templed his fingers and studied the fool. Unpredictable, cunning, and careless, the jester had not yet been foolish enough to risk their race.
Go on.
The fool cocked his head and his smile gleamed in the half-light.
It's simple. The wedding can't take place now. King James is going to destroy the Douglas. Oh, the Coman, too, he added irreverently.
Ah!
Finvera debated a pensive moment. He didn't have to lift a finger and the hawk would soon die. But it wasn't enough, he seethed. Finvera wanted his own hand in the hawk's destruction. He had suffered personal insult, and he wanted an intimately personal revenge. No mortal man cuckolded the king of the fairy without divine retribution. And how divine it would feel to destroy the hawk! The glimmer of an idea began to take shape in his mind. As he considered it, King Finvera felt more vital than he had in centuries. The fool didn't miss the smug smile that teased the king's lips.
You're thinking something wicked. What are you planning, my liege? The fool asked.
Silence! King Finvera commanded.
He rubbed his jaw thoughtfully as he sifted through his options, carefully refining his scheme. If time passed while Finvera plotted, neither fairy noticed. Time meant little to the race of beings who could move about in it at will. The first flames of dawn painted the sky above the sea when the king spoke again.
Has the hawk ever loved?
Loved?
The fool echoed blankly.
You know, that emotion for which mortals compose sonnets. Fight wars, erect monuments, the king said dryly.
The fool reflected a moment.
I would say no, my king. The hawk has never wooed a woman he didn't win, nor does it appear he ever desired any special woman over another.
A woman has never denied him?
King Finvera asked with a trace of incredulity.
Not that I could find. I don't think the woman lives and breathes in the 16th century who could deny him. I'm telling you, the man's a legend. Women swoon over him.
The king smiled avariciously.
I have another errand for you, fool.
Anything, my liege. Let me kill him.
No. There will be no blood spilled by our hand. Listen to me carefully. Go now through the centuries. Go forward. Women are more independent and self-possessed there. Find me a woman who is irresistible, exquisite, intelligent, strong, one who knows her own mind. Bid you well. She must be a woman who won't lose her wits being tossed through time. She must be adaptable to strange events. It wouldn't do to bring her to him and have her brain addled. She must believe in a bit of magic.
The fool nodded.
Too true. Remember that tax accountant we took back to the 12th century? She turned into a raving lunatic.
Exactly. The woman you find must be somewhat inured to the unusual, so she can accept time travel without coming undone.
Finvera mulled this over a moment.
I have it. Look in Salem, where they still believe in witches, or perhaps New Orleans, where the ancient magic sizzles in the air.
Perfect places, the fool enthused.
But most important, fool, you must find me a woman who harbors a special hatred for beautiful, womanizing men. A woman guaranteed to make that mortal's life a living hell.
The fool smiled fiendishly.
May I embellish on your plan?
You're a crucial part of it, the king said, with sinister promise.
Adrian de Simone shivered, although it was an unusually warm May evening in Seattle. She pulled a sweater over her head and tugged the French doors closed. She stared out through the glass and watched the night descend over the gardens that tumbled in wild disarray beyond the walk. In the fading light, she surveyed the stone wall that protected her house at 93 Coteil Lane, then turned her methodical scrutiny to the shadows beneath the stately oaks, seeking any irregular movement. She took a deep breath and ordered herself to relax. The guard dogs that patrolled the grounds were quiet. Things must be safe, she assured herself firmly. Inexplicably tense, she entered the code on the alarm pad that would activate the motion detector strategically mounted throughout the one-acre lawn. Any non-random motion over 100 pounds in mass and 3 feet in height would trigger the detectors, although the shrill warning would not summon the police or any law enforcement agency. Adrian would run for her gun before she'd run for a phone. She'd summon the devil himself before she'd dream of calling the police. Although 6 months had passed, Adrian still felt as if she couldn't get far enough from New Orleans, not even if she moved across an ocean or two, which she couldn't do anyway. The percentage of fugitives apprehended while trying to leave the country was shockingly high. Was that what she really was? She marveled. It never failed to astonish her, even after all these months. How could she, Adrian de Simone, be a fugitive? She'd always been an honest, law-abiding citizen. All she'd ever asked of life was a home and a place to belong, someone to love and someone who loved her. Children, someday. Children she would never abandon to an orphanage. She'd found all of that in Eberhard Darrow Garrett, the toast of New Orleans society. Or so she'd thought. Adrian snorted as she surveyed the lawn a final time, then dropped the drapes across the doors. A few years ago, the world had seemed like such a different place, a wonderful place, full of promise, excitement, and endless possibility. Armed only with her irrepressible spirit and $300 cash, Adrian Doe had invented a last name for herself and fled the orphanage on the day she'd turned 18. She'd been thrilled to discover student loans for which practically anyone could qualify, even an unsecured risk like an orphan. She'd taken a job as a waitress, enrolled in college, and embarked on her quest to make something of herself. Just what? She wasn't sure, but she'd always had a feeling that something special was waiting around the next corner for her. She'd been 20, a sophomore at the university when that special thing had happened. Working at the Blind Lemon, an elegant restaurant and bar, Adrian had caught the eye, the heart, and the engagement ring of the darkly handsome, wealthy Eberhard Darrow Garrett, the bachelor of the decade. It had been the perfect fairy tale. She'd walked around for months on clouds of happiness. When the clouds had started to melt beneath her feet, she'd refused to look too closely, refused to acknowledge that the fairy tale prince might be a prince of darker things. Adrian squeezed her eyes shut, wishing she could blink some of her bad memories out of existence. How gullible she'd been! How many excuses she'd made for him, for herself, until she'd finally had to run. A tiny meow coaxed her back to the present, and she smiled down at the one good thing that had come of it all, her kitten, Moonshadow, a precocious stray she'd found outside a gas station on her way north. Mooney rubbed her ankles and purred enthusiastically. Adrian scooped up the furry little creature, hugging her close. Unconditional love. Such was the gift Mooney gave. Love without reservation or subterfuge. Pure affection, with no darker sides. Adrian hummed lightly as she rubbed Mooney's ears, then broke off abruptly as a faint scratching sound drew her attention to the windows again. Perfectly still, she clutched Mooney and waited, holding her breath. But there was only silence. It must have been a twig scratching at the roof, she decided. But hadn't she cut all the trees back from the house when she'd moved in? Adrian sighed, shook her head, and ordered her muscles to relax. She had nearly succeeded when overhead a floorboard creaked. Tension reclaimed her instantly. She dropped Mooney on a stuffed chair and eyed the ceiling intently as the creaking sound repeated. Perhaps it was just the house settling. She really had to get over this skittishness. How much time had to pass until she stopped being afraid that she would turn around and see Eberhard standing there, with his faintly mocking smile and gleaming gun? Eberhard was dead. She was safe. She knew she was. So why did she feel so horridly vulnerable? For the past few days, she'd had the suffocating sensation that someone was spying on her, no matter how hard she tried to reassure herself that anyone who might wish her harm was either dead or didn't know she was alive. She was still consumed by a morbid unease. Every instinct she possessed warned her that something was wrong, or about to go terribly wrong. Having grown up in the city of spooks, the sultry, superstitious, magical New Orleans, Adrian had learned to listen to her instincts. They were almost always right on target. Her instincts had even been right about Eberhard. She'd had a bad feeling about him from the beginning, but she'd convinced herself it was her own insecurity. Eberhard was the catch of New Orleans. Naturally, a woman might feel a little unsettled by such a man. Only much later did she understand that she'd been lonely for so long and had wanted the fairy tale so badly that she'd tried to force reality to reflect her desires instead of the other way around. She'd told herself so many white lies before finally facing the truth that Eberhard wasn't the man she'd thought he was. She'd been such a fool. Adrian breathed deeply of the spring air that breezed gently in the window behind her, then flinched and spun abruptly. She eyed the fluttering drapes warily. Hadn't she closed that window? She was sure of it. She'd closed all of them just before closing the French doors. Adrian edged cautiously to the window, shut it quickly, and locked it. It was nerves. Nothing more. No face peered in the window at her, no dogs barked, no alarms sounded. What was the use of taking so many precautions if she couldn't relax? There couldn't possibly be anyone out there. Adrian forced herself to turn away from the window. As she padded across the room, her foot encountered a small object and sent it skidding across the faded Ushak rug, where it clunked to a rest against the wall. Adrian glanced at it and flinched. It was a piece from Eberhard's chess set, the one she'd swiped from his house in New Orleans the night she'd fled. She'd forgotten all about it after she'd moved in. She'd tossed it in a box, one of those piled in the corner that she'd never gotten around to unpacking. Perhaps Mooney had dragged the pieces out, she mused. There were several of them scattered across the rug. She retrieved the piece she'd kicked and rolled it gingerly between her fingers. Waves of emotion flooded her, a sea of shame and anger and humiliation, capped with a relentless fear that she still wasn't safe. A draft of air kissed the back of her neck, and she stiffened, clutching the chess piece so tightly that the crown of the Black Queen dug cruelly into her palm. Logic insisted that the windows behind her were shut. She knew they were. Still, instinct told her otherwise. The rational Adrian knew there was no one in her library but herself and a lightly snoring kitten. The irrational Adrian teetered on the brink of terror. Laughing nervously, she berated herself for being so jumpy, then cursed Eberhard for making her this way. She would not succumb to paranoia. Dropping to her knees without sparing a backward glance, Adrian scooped the scattered chess pieces into a pile. She didn't really like to touch them. A woman couldn't spend her childhood in New Orleans, much of it at the feet of a Creole storyteller who'd lived behind the orphanage, without becoming a bit superstitious. The set was ancient, an original Viking set. An old legend claimed it was cursed, and Adrian's life had been cursed enough. The only reason she'd pilfered the set was in case she'd needed quick cash. Carved of walrus, ivory, and ebony, it would command an exorbitant price from a collector. Besides, hadn't she earned it, after all he'd put her through? Adrian muttered a colorful invective about beautiful men. It wasn't morally acceptable that someone as evil as Eberhard had been so nice to look at. Poetic justice demanded otherwise. Shouldn't people's faces reflect their hearts? If Eberhard had been as ugly on the outside as she'd belatedly discovered he was on the inside, she never would have ended up at the wrong end of a gun. Of course, Adrian had learned the hard way that any end of a gun was the wrong end. Eberhard Darrow Garrett was a beautiful, womanizing, deceitful man, and he'd ruined her life. Clutching the Black Queen tightly, she made herself a firm promise.
I will never go out with a beautiful man again, so long as I live and breathe. I hate beautiful men. Hate them!
Outside the French doors at 93 Coattail Lane, a man who lacked substance, a creature man-made devices could neither detect nor contain, heard her words and smiled. His choice was made with swift certainty. Adrienne de Simone was definitely the woman he'd been searching for. Chapter 3. Adrienne had no idea how she ended up on the man's lap. None. One moment she was perfectly sane, perhaps a bit neurotic, but firmly convinced of her sanity nonetheless. And the next moment, the ground disappeared beneath her feet, and she was sucked down one of Alice's rabbit holes. Her first thought was that she must be dreaming, a vivid, horrifying subconscious foray into a barbaric nightmare. But that didn't make any sense. Only moments before, she'd been petting Moonshadow or doing... something. What? She couldn't have just fallen asleep without even knowing it. Maybe. She'd stumbled and struck her head, and this hallucination was the dreamy result of a concussion. Or maybe not, she worried as she looked around the cavernous, smoky room filled with oddly dressed people speaking a mutilated version of the English tongue. You've done it now, Adrienne, she mused soberly. You've finally slipped over the edge, heels still kicking. Adrienne struggled to focus her eyes, which felt strangely heavy. The man who clutched her was revolting. He was a belching beast with thick arms and a fat belly, and he smelled. Only moments ago she'd been in her library, hadn't she? A greasy hand squeezed her breast, and she yelped aloud. Bewilderment was vanquished by embarrassed outrage when his hand deliberately grazed the crest of her nipple through her sweater. Even if this was a dream, she couldn't permit that kind of activity to pass without redress. She opened her mouth to deliver a scathing tongue-lashing, but he beat her to the punch. His pink mouth in that tangled mass of hair expanded into a wide O. Dear heaven, but the man hadn't even finished chewing. And no wonder. His few remaining teeth were stumpy and brown. It was with revulsion that Adrienne wiped bits of chicken and spittle from her face when he roared. But it was with genuine alarm that she comprehended his words, through his thick brogue. She was a godsend, he proclaimed to the room at large. She was a gift from the angels. She would be married on the morrow. Adrienne fainted. Her unconscious body spasmed once, then went limp. The Black Queen slipped from her hand, hit the floor, and was kicked under a table by a scuffed leather boot. When Adrienne awoke, she lay still, her eyes squeezed tightly shut. Beneath her back she felt the lumpy down ticks piled thickly. It could be her own bed. She had purchased antique ticks and had them restitched to plump atop her waist-high Queen Anne bed. She was in love with old things, no dithering about it. She sniffed cautiously. No odd scents from the banquet she'd dreamt. No hum of that thick brogue she'd imagined earlier. But no traffic, either. She strained her ears, listening mightily. Had she ever heard such silence? Adrienne drew a ragged breath and willed her heart to slow. She tossed on the lumpy tick. Was this how insanity occurred? Starting with a vague inkling of unease, a dreadful sense of being watched, then escalated rapidly into full-blown madness, only to culminate in a nightmare where a smelly, hairy beast announced her impending nuptials? Adrienne squeezed her eyes even more tightly shut, willing her return to sanity. The silhouette of a chess set loomed in her mind, battle-ready rooks and bitter queens etched in stark relief against the insides of her eyelids. And it seemed that there was something urgent she needed to remember. What had she been doing? Her head hurt. It was a dull kind of ache, accompanied by the bitter taste of old pennies in the back of her throat. For a moment she struggled against it, but the throbbing intensified. The chess set danced elusively in shades of black and white, then dissolved into a distant, nagging detail. It couldn't have been too important. Adrienne had more pressing things to worry about. Where in the blue blazes was she? She kept her eyes closed and waited. A few moments more and she would hear the purr of a BMW tooling sleekly down Coattail Lane, or her phone would peal angrily. A rooster did not just crow. Another minute and she'd hear Moonies questioning, meow, and feel her tail swish past her face as she leapt up on the bed. She did not hear the grate of squeaky hinges, the scrape of a door cut too long against a stone threshold.
"'M'lady, I know you're awake.'
Her eyes sprang open to find a portly woman with silver-brown hair and rosy cheeks, wringing her hands as she stood at the foot of the bed.
Who are you?
Adrian asked warily, refusing to look at any more of the room than the immediate spot that contained this latest apparition.
Bah! Who am I, she asks. The lass who pops out of nowhere, lickety-split, like a witch, if you please, is wishing to know who I am. Huh!
With that, the woman placed a platter of peculiar-smelling food on a nearby table and forced Adrian up by plumping the pillows behind her back.
I'm Talia. I've been sent to see to your care. Eat up. You'll never be strong enough to face wedding him if you don't be eating, she chided.
With those words and a full glimpse of the stone walls hung with vividly colored tapestries depicting hunts and orgies, Adrian fainted again, this time with relish. Adrian awoke again to a score of maids bearing undergarments, stockings, and a wedding dress. The women bathed her in scented water before a massive stone fireplace. While she huddled, submerged in the deep wooden tub, Adrian examined every inch of the room. How could a dream be so vivid, so rich with scent and touch and sound? The bathwater smelled of fresh heather and lilac. The maids chatted lightly as they bathed her. The stone fireplace was easily as tall as three men. It rose up to kiss the ceiling and sprawled along half the width of the east wall. It was bedecked with an array of artistic silverwork, delicately filigreed baskets, cunningly handcrafted roses that gleamed like molten silver, yet each petal distinct and looking somehow velvety. Above the great mantle, rough-hewn of honey oak, hung a hunt scene depicting a bloody victory. Her study was cut short by the screech of the door. Shocked gasps and immediately hushed voices compelled her gaze over one bare shoulder, and she too gasped aloud. The villain with the matted rug upon his face. Her cheeks flamed with embarrassment, and she sank deeper into the tub.
My lord, 'tis no place for you,
a maid began. The slap ricocheted through the room, silencing the maid's protest, and halting anyone else's before they even considered beginning. The great, greasy beast from earlier in her nightmare sank down on his haunches before the steaming tub, a leer on his face. Slitted blue eyes met steely gray as Adrian held his rude stare levelly. His eyes dropped from hers, searched the waterline and probed below it. He grinned at the sight of her rosy nipples before she crossed her arms and hugged herself tightly.
"Methinks he doesn't do so badly for himself," the man murmured.
Then, dragging his eyes from the water to her flushed face, he commanded,
"From this moment forth, your name is Janet Gorman."
Adrian shot him a haughty look.
"My name," she snapped, "is Adrian de Simone."
Crack!
She raised a hand to her cheek in disbelief. A maid cried out a muffled warning.
"Try it again," he counseled softly.
And as soft as his words were, his blue eyes were dangerously hard. Adrian rubbed her stinging cheek in silence, and his hand rose and fell again.
"My lady, we implore you."
A petite maid dropped to her knees beside the tub, placing a hand upon Adrian's bare shoulder.
"That's right. Give her counsel, Bess. You know what becomes of a lass foolish enough to deny me. Say it," he repeated to Adrian. "Tell me your name is Janet Gorman."
When his beefy hand rose and fell again, it came down on Bess's face with fury. Adrian screamed as he struck the maid repeatedly.
"Stop!"
she cried.
"Say it!"
he commanded as his hand rose and fell again. Bess sobbed as she crumpled to the floor, but the man went down after her, his hand now a fist.
"My name is Janet Coleman!"
Adrian cried, half rising from the tub. The Coleman's fist halted in midair, and he sank back on his haunches, the light of victory gleaming in his eyes. Victory, and that disgusting, slow perusal of her flesh. Adrian flushed under the sheer lechery of his pale eyes and plunged her upper body back into the water.
"Nay, he doesn't get a bad bargain at all. You are much more comely than mine own Janet."
His mouth twisted into a smile.
"Would that I had leisure to taste such plump pillows myself. But you came just in the nick of time."
"Came where?"
"Came from where is my question," he countered.
Adrian realized in that instant that to underestimate this brutish man would be a grave mistake, for behind the slovenly manners and the unkempt appearance was steely metal and rapier-sharp wit, the flabby arm that had felled the blows couched muscle, the pale slitted eyes that wandered restlessly didn't miss a beat. He hadn't punished Bess in rage. He'd beat her in a cold, calculated act to get what he wanted from Adrian. She shook her head, her eyes wide with confusion.
Really? I haven't the faintest idea how I got here.
You don't know where you came from?
Bess was sobbing softly, and Adrian's eyes darkened as she watched the maid curl into a ball and surreptitiously try to inch away from the Komen. His hand shot out and fastened on the maid's ankle. Bess whimpered hopelessly.
Och, nay, my pretty. I may need you yet.
His eyes swept her shuddering form with a possessive leer. Adrian gasped when he ripped Bess's gown and proceeded to shred it from her body. Adrian's stomach churned in agony when she saw the great welts rising from the maid's pale flanks and thighs, cruel, biting welts from a belt or a whip. The other maids fled the room, leaving her alone with the weeping Bess and the madman.
"This is my world, Adrian de Simone," he intoned, and Adrian had a premonition that the words he was about to utter would be carved deeply into her mind for a long time to come.
He stroked Bess's quivering thigh lightly.
"My rules, my people, my will to command life or death, yours and hers. 'Tis a simple thing I want of you. If you don't cooperate, she dies. Then another, and still another. I will find the very core of that foolish compassion you wear like a shroud. It makes you so easy to use. But women are that way. Weak."
Adrian sat hunched in silence, her labored breathing an accompaniment to Bess's weary sobs.
"Quiet, lass!"
He slapped the maid's face, and she curled into a tighter ball, weeping into her hands to smother the sound.
"One day, I will kill him with my bare hands," Adrian vowed silently.
"I don't know how you came to be here, or who you are, and frankly, I don't care. I have a problem, and you're going to fix it. If you ever forget what I'm about to tell you, if you ever slip, if you ever betray me, I will kill you after I've destroyed everything you care about."
"Where am I?"
she asked tonelessly, reluctantly voicing one of the questions that had been bothering her. She was afraid that once she started asking questions, she might discover this really wasn't a dream after all.
"I don't care if you're mad," he chuckled appreciatively. "Fact is, I rather relish the thought that you might have the bats flapping in your belfry. God knows my Janet did. 'Tis no more or less than he deserves."
"Where am I?"
she insisted.
Janet had a difficult time remembering that, too.
"So? Where am I?"
The Komen studied her, then shrugged.
"Scotland. Komen Keep. My keep."
Her heart stopped beating within her breast. It was not possible. Had she truly gone mad? Adrian steeled her will to ask the next question. The obvious question, the terrifying question she'd been studiously avoiding since she'd first awoken. She'd learned that sometimes it was safer not to ask too many questions. The answers could be downright unnerving. Obtaining the answer to this question could tamper with her fragile grasp on reason. Adrian had a suspicion that where she wasn't quite the only problem she had. Drawing a deep breath, she asked carefully,
"What year is it?"
The Komen guffawed.
"You really are a wee bit daft, aren't you, lass?"
Adrian glared at him in silence. He shrugged again.
"'Tis 1513.
"Oh,"
Adrian said faintly.
"Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God," she wailed in the confines of her reeling mind.
She took a deep, slow breath and told herself to start at the beginning of this mystery. Perhaps it could be unraveled.
"And who exactly are you?"
"For all intents and purposes,
I am your father, lass. That's the first of many things you must never forget.
A broken sob temporarily distracted Adrian from her problems. Poor, abused Bess. Adrian could not bear a person in pain, not if she could do something about it. This man wanted something from her. Maybe she could bargain for something in exchange.
Let Bess go, she said.
Do you pledge your fealty to me in this matter?
He had the flat eyes of a snake, Adrian realized, like the python in the Seattle Zoo.
Let her go from this keep. Give her her freedom,
she clarified.
Nay, m'lady,
Bess shrieked, and the beast chuckled warmly. His eyes were thoughtful as he stroked Bess's leg.
Methinks, Janet Coleman, you don't understand much of this world. Free her from me, and you condemn her to death by starvation, rape, or worse. Free her from my loving attentions. And the next man may not be so loving. Your own husband may not be so loving.
Adrian shivered violently as she struggled to tear her gaze from the plump white hand stroking rhythmically. The source of Bess's pain was the same hand that fed her, protected her. Bile rose in Adrian's throat, almost choking her.
Fortunately, he already thinks you're mad, so you may talk as you will after this day. But for this day, from dawn till dusk, you will swear that you are Janet Coleman, only blood daughter of the mighty Red Coleman, sworn bride of Shahak Douglas. You will see this day through as I tell you.
But what of the real Janet?
She couldn't help but ask.
Slap!
How had the man managed to hit her before she could so much as blink? As he stood quivering with rage above her, he said,
The next blows won't be to your face, bitch, for the gown won't cover there. But there are ways to hit that hurt the most, and leave no mark. Don't push me.
Adrian was silent and obedient through all the things he told her then. His message was plain. If she was silent and obedient, she would stay alive. Dream or no dream, the blows hurt here, and she had a feeling the dying might just hurt here too. He told her things then, hundreds of details he expected her to commit to memory. She did so with determination. It temporarily prevented her from contemplating the full extent of her apparent insanity. She repeated each detail, each name, each memory that was not hers. From careful observation of her father, she was able to guess at many of the memories that had belonged to the woman whose identity she was now to assume. And all the while a soft mantra hummed through the back of her mind.
This cannot be happening. This is not possible. This cannot be happening.
Yet in the forefront of her mind, realist that she was, she understood that the words can't and impossible had no bearing when the impossible was indeed happening. Unless she woke up soon from a nightmarish and vivid dream, she was in Scotland. The year was 1513, and she was indeed getting married. Chapter 4
She's tall as Janet.
Not many as tall as she.
Hush! She is Janet, else he'll have our heads on serving platters.
What happened to Janet?
Adrian asked softly. She wasn't surprised when the mouths of a half-dozen maids clamped shut, and they turned their complete attention to dressing her in stalwart silence. Adrian rolled her eyes. If they wouldn't tell her a thing about Janet, perhaps they'd talk about her bridegroom.
So, who is this man I am to wed?
Sidhawk Douglas. What kind of a name was Sidhawk, anyway? The maids tittered like a covey of startled quail.
Truth of it is, m'lady, we've only heard tales of him. This betrothal was commanded by King James himself.
What are the tales?
Adrian asked wryly.
His exploits are legendary. His conquests are legion. 'Tis rumored he's traveled the world, accompanied by only the most beautiful lasses. 'Tis said there is not a comely lass in all of Scotia he has not tumbled, in England too, and he cannot recall any of their names. He is said to have godlike beauty, and a practised hand in the fine art of seduction. He is fabulously wealthy, and rumors say his castle is luxurious beyond compare.
Adrian blinked.
Wonderful.
A materialistic, unfaithful, beautiful playboy of a self-indulged, inconsiderate man with a bad memory. And is all mine. Dear, sweet God, what have I done to deserve this?
She wondered aloud. Twice, she brooded privately. Lisbel looked at her curiously.
But the rumors tell he is a magnificent lover, and most comely to look upon, milady. What could be wrong with that?
Methinks you don't understand this world, Janet Coleman, he had said.
Perhaps he was right.
Does he beat his women?
He doesn't keep them long enough, or so they say. Although I hear tell one of his women tried to kill him recently. I can't imagine why,
the maid added, genuinely puzzled.
'Tis said he's more than generous with his mistresses when he's done with them.
I can imagine why,
Adrian grumbled irritably, suddenly impatient with all the plucking, fastening, adorning, and arranging hands on her body.
Stop! Stop!
She lightly slapped Lisbel's hands from her hair, which had been washed, combed mercilessly, and teased torturously for what felt like years.
But, milady, we must do something with this hair. 'Tis so straight. You must look your best.
Personally, I'd prefer to look like something the cat dragged in. Wet, bedraggled, and smelling like a ripe dung heap.
Gasps resounded.
Lass, he will be your husband, and you could do far worse.
A stern voice cut across the room. Adrian turned slowly and met the worldly wise gaze of a woman with whom she felt an instant kinship.
You could have mine, for lack of a better example.
Adrian sucked in a harsh breath.
The Laird Coleman?
Your father, my darling daughter,
Lady Althea Coleman said with an acid smile.
Be gone, all of you.
She ushered the maids from the room with a regal hand, her eyes lingering over long on Bess.
He'll kill the lass one day, he will,
she said softly. She squeezed her eyes shut tightly for a long moment.
He explained what you must do.
Adrian nodded.
And you will do it?
Again she nodded. The Lady Coleman expelled a sigh of relief.
If there is aught a time I may repay the kindness. It's not a kindness. It's to save my life. You need only ask, for it saves mine own.
Adrian stood tall before the man of the cloth, fulfilling her part of the farce.
I am Janet Coleman,
she proclaimed loudly. God's man paled visibly and clutched his Bible until his knuckles looked to split at the seams.
So he knows I'm not, she mused.
What on earth is really going on here?
She felt a presence near her left shoulder, and turned reluctantly to face the man she was to wed. Her eyes met the area slightly below his breastbone, and every inch of it was encased in steel. Adrian started to rise and look her fiancé in the face, when she realized with horror that she wasn't kneeling. Beyond chagrined, she tipped her head back and swallowed a thousand frantic protests that clotted in her throat. The giant stared back with an inscrutable expression, flames from flickering candles dancing in the bluest eyes she'd ever seen.
I can't marry him, she screamed silently. I can't do it.
Her eyes fled his countenance and chafed lightly across the audience, in search of someone to save her from this debacle. Bess sat in the rear pew, eyes closed in supplication. Adrian flinched and closed her eyes in kind.
Please, God, if I've gone mad, please make me sane again. And if I haven't gone mad and somehow this is really happening, I'm sorry I wasn't grateful for the 20th century. I'm sorry I did what I did to Eberhard. I'm sorry for everything, and I promise I'll be a better person if you just get me out of here.
When she opened her eyes again, she could have sworn the man of the cloth had a knowing and rather amused gleam in his eye.
Help me,
she mouthed silently. Quickly he lowered his eyes to the floor. He didn't raise them again. In spite of herself, Adrian dragged her reluctant gaze to the midsection of her bridegroom, then upward even farther to his darkly handsome face. He arched a brow at her as the flutists piped away, the rhythm increasing in gaiety and tempo. She was rescued from the stress of his regard when a ruckus erupted and she heard the furious voice of her father carrying to the rafters.
What say you, he couldn't have come himself?
Red Comyn shouted at the soldier.
"'Twas a bit of a problem in North Ooster. The hawk had to ride out in haste, but he hasna forsaken his pledge. He does no dishonour to the clans.'
The soldier delivered his rehearsed message.
"'He dishonors the troth by not being here!'
Lord Comyn roared. Then he turned to the man at Adrian's side.
"'And who are you to come in his stead?'
"'Grim Roderick, Hawk's captain of the guard. I come to wed your daughter as his proxy.'
"'A pox on proxy! How dare he not come to claim my daughter himself?'
"'That's perfectly legal. The king will recognize it, and the troth is thus fulfilled.'
Adrian couldn't prevent the joy that leapt into her face at his words. This man wasn't her husband.
"'Am I so offensive then, lass?' he asked, smiling mockingly, not missing 1 ounce of her relief.
"'About as offensive as a platter of strawberries dipped in dark chocolate and topped with whipped cream,' she thought wryly.
"'I'd sooner marry a toad,'
Adrian said. His laughter teased a miserly smile from her lips.
"'Then you're definitely out of luck, milady, for the hawk is no toad, for certain.
I, lass, standing next to the hawk, am truly a toad, nay, a troll. Worse still, a horned and warty lizard.
I get the picture.
Dear heaven, deliver me from perfection, she thought.
Where is he, then, my unwilling husband?
Managing the aftermath of a serious problem.
And that might be...
Grave and